ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
This is The Book Show. Hello, I'm Claire Nichols, coming to you from Ghana Land in Adelaide, where I am here for Adelaide Writers' Week. This is one of my favourite festivals of the year. The atmosphere is so wonderful. We're all together under the trees. Authors roam around amongst the readers, and there's multiple sessions happening at the same time. Lots of incredible ideas being shared. It really is so great to be here. And here in Adelaide, I've had the great pleasure of speaking to Anne Enright. I think there might be no better writer at capturing the complications and the contradictions at the heart of families, the love, the damage, the joy, and the cruelty. Anne won the Booker in 2007 for her wonderful novel, The Gathering, and her latest is The Wren, The Wren. It's about a straight-laced mum, her free spirit daughter, and the poet father who left them in the lurch. Here's my conversation with Anne Enright.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Lovely to be here. Thank you.
And I was just telling you before we came on stage that I've had you in my head for the last couple of weeks because I've been listening to you read me The Gathering on audiobook, which you didn't remember you'd done.
Yeah, no, it doesn't make me feel very comfortable to think that I've been in your head either. That's also a little bit strange. Yeah, no, I must have read the audiobook at some stage. I do remember in 2007, 2008, the wonderful actor Fiona Shaw, the Irish actor from Cork, read the book. And she did a kind of thing with it. She made it seem like Tolstoy. Just so integrated and intelligent and smooth. I mean, I could feel her rewriting the book in a more kind of proper way as she read it through. But it's not a proper book. I mean, it's a book that wants to fragment, it wants to fall apart. I mean, I loved her rendition, but it's really interesting to do the voices yourself because they're in my head. And I suppose on some level, it's nice that they can, I can get the rhythms and the syntax into your reading eye, you know.
And you were an actress, so I'm wondering
for 2 minutes.
I'm wondering if that satisfies some sort of
performer
in you.
Sadness. Actually, I wrote a book about the sadness of acting. The last one out was Actress. Does it satisfy? I mean, I think that acting in the creative mode of acting is a really good training for writing because there's something improvisational about what you're doing at the desk. You know, you do the funny voices in your head. I used to move around a bit.
Really?
Yeah, I've successfully internalized it now, so I don't look so stupid as I write. You know, you might move around a bit. It can also, just because so much of the sense of it and the emotion of it is carried in the cadences and the rhythm, so it can almost be quite a physical thing. It's sometimes good to walk around the room.
With you reading me The Gathering, it's been really interesting for me because a lot of what the narrator talks about in that book is the sometimes futility of being a mother. Like, why do we fold the clothes? They're just going to get opened up again. You know, why do we empty the dishwasher? They're just, more dishes are going in. Listening to you tell me that while I'm hanging the washing on the line, it really makes you question everything.
Yeah, well, Veronica in The Gathering is not in what it might be called a good place. But there is, I suppose, and domestic labour can seem futile if you're not Dutch. or some Buddhists like it as well, you know. That, you know, making things nice and making things nice and making things nice, as opposed to going, oh my God, not again.
Yeah, now I have you saying that in my head while I do those chores. So that's really special.
Well, that's Veronica. She doesn't see the point of reproduction. Her mother reproduced too much.
12 children.
Yeah, 12 living children. In those style of Irish families, there are always the children that didn't make it into adulthood in one way or another. So, and one of them has died. So it's that Beckettian phrase that she converts the phrase of, you know, I think he says the cradle is the grave, but she says we give birth over the grave. So she's very keenly aware of the mortality that's involved in giving life, you know. If it's something you give, I don't know, in producing life. Mm. So that makes her keenly aware of it's a real existential problem for her when her brother dies. What was that about? So, yeah, I mean, then there's the laundry. As always, you know, I like to keep it real.
I think for a long time, there was this idea that as a woman, you could be an artist or you could be a mother, but you couldn't be both. Do you, like, when you were starting out, was that present for you? Was that something you had to wrangle with?
I'm really realizing I've been around for a very long time now and things have changed, and some things are not recognizable anymore. But there was a really strange idea, you're quite right, that if you created a child as though it was you in some way doing the creating, that would just kind of remove all your other creativity surgically, like it would fall out of you in the maternity ward. So anyway, I don't want to bring the metaphor along too far. That was a funny thing to think. It actually affected some male writers as well. Evelyn Waugh couldn't write if his children were in the house or in the wing of the house, being Evelyn Waugh, where he was. And there was a kind of writerly rage against the pram and the hall, which was not just about... Not just about the domestic being the enemy of the free and the artistic. It was also something that these men felt they had been robbed by having children, that they had been personally deprived of something. And that's very inexplicable and strange, I think. So when it came to women, it was clear that women couldn't write. And there were a number of women, Doris Lessingham was a notable one, a number of women who realised in their time that they had to leave their children in order to become writers. I was always of the opinion that there's no becoming involved. There's a lot of typing involved in being a writer, but becoming is not part of it. And that you can type in any room of the house, and sometimes you can type while they're there, and they're not stealing. They're not stealing. Sometimes it feels as though they are, though. They're taking your time, certainly. They're taking a huge chunk of your emotional awareness. But that's not your book. Anyway, the young women these days can't be stopped. They cannot be stopped.
But for you, did it feel risky? Did it feel like you were doing something that hadn't been tested?
Yeah, it did feel slightly new. But so did my mortgage.
Reality was knocking at the door.
Yeah, no, children are expensive.
I read your non-fiction book, Making Babies, which you wrote some time ago when your kids were young.
Yeah.
Zero to two, I think they were in that book.
Yes.
And you write so beautifully about the love and madness of being a new mum, because I think it can be as mad as it is loving, right?
Yeah, well, I was older, I think, when I had my children. So I had so much kind of ordinary dullness preceding it. I couldn't figure it out at all for the first time.
There's a line in The Gathering, I think it is, and our narrator Veronica is a new mum, and she talks about, she's just had the baby, she's in the hospital room, and she talks about the thick and ecstatic sunshine coming through the window. It's like, almost like the chemistry of the whole world around her has changed. You're seeing things differently, right?
Yeah. Well, chemically, you're different. I did actually think that my brain changed with maternity. And there's a lot of, you know, jokes around about it making you stupid. I said to my obstetrician, you know, your brain shrinks by 3% when you're pregnant, looking for reassurance. And she says, you never get it back, she said. And then she said, I've had four. I don't know, a brain the size of a walnut rattling around inside, figuring out my medical issue. Anyway, so... Actually, they've done tests about multitasking and things like that, that I really did feel there was a fairly fundamental, there was some kind of interesting shift that happened in my mind on some level. You know, you're right, and people talk about identity a lot, but I never talk about identity because, in part because of this amazing duality that is pregnancy in the first year or so of after childbirth. Actually, that happens in the Wren. She says that the first weeks aren't the end of pregnancy. They're just pregnancy externalized. Mm. You're just doing the same thing, but on the outside now. So this kind of symbiotic thing, or this doubleness, some very individualistic people find it a real challenge to their sense of themselves as a kind of independent unit, you know. And I suppose I had that too. But I felt I was just kind of multiplying, not me and not me anymore. Just it was just a different state for a while.
Mm. And it was giving you material, right? Like, you write so well about
families. Oh, God, writers get material everywhere, you know what I mean? You don't need to have children to get material. I think Flannery O'Connor said you know all you need to know by the age of 18. You know, and people say, write what you know. And when I wrote my first book, my mother said, how did you know that? People know a lot. I mean, that's one of the things I tell my students is about accessing what you know and not censoring what you know or what you could say.
You are so good at that, though. I think I read your books and you say something that feels so true, yet I don't think anyone else has ever quite thought about it that way before or expressed it in that way before. What are you doing there? Are you walking out in the world and writing things down? Are you listening more closely to people? Like, how are you finding those things that you know and getting them to the page? No, with you know, that decreased brain size from the baby.
Enter into the space of a book and you're in a really profound, in deep state of imagining. You know, it's a silly business writing fiction. These people don't exist. And you're sort of living with them. They feel to me like real people. It takes me a while to leave them behind. The book isn't finished when it's done. It kind of trails on like a reverb. They're still around now, whereas the people in my earlier books are kind of quiet. So you're with them for a very long time and you're making shapes and stories with them. And they're a little bit, it's a little bit like how you might, you know, talk about people to someone you're close to. You say, I'm very worried about so-and-so. You know what happened? You know, that happened and then she did this and I don't think, you know. What's that about? So you're involved in this conversation in your head with your characters as though they and their problems were somehow real as well.
And are Carmel and Nell still there for you now?
Yeah.
Yeah? What are they doing?
Fading.
Is that a welcome thing to say goodbye?
I used to feel great grief at the end of a book. You know, I cried at the end of The Gathering and it was a sad, sad book. And it was quite cathartic, I suppose. But I also cried because I was leaving them all behind as well. But somebody said to me, how do you know a book is done? And I said, because I have a little weep. I didn't weep at this one. This is a nice ending to the book.
It is. So this is Adelaide Writers Week. This is the book show coming to you from Adelaide Writers Week, where I am so lucky to be speaking to Anne Enright. Anne's latest novel is called The Wren, and it's about a uniquely damaged family, including the patriarch, a famous poet called Phil McDarrah. And I want to talk about poetry a bit, Anne.
Yeah.
How big a deal were Irish poets when you were growing up?
Well, they really do have a place in society. I mean, I remember the first time I met Seamus Heaney, and I don't want to ever forget it, and how great that made me feel, and how I could go home and say it, and how nice he was. And also how the feeling then, before and after that, of that if you took down a poetry book by Seamus off the shelf, you would find the right poem. Wherever you opened it, it would be the right poem. So there was something magical about them, some ancient, very folkloric sense of them being enhancing and separate. But when I was growing up, I mean, we had Austin Clark, who features in the book because he's the head reviewer of the Irish Times and annoys Phil so much that he goes about clattering his children upside the head when he has to read Austin Clark in the paper on a Saturday. But he lived about a mile away or half a mile away from where I grew up in a house in Temple Oak on the bridge there. And it would be pointed out as the house of the poet. And there was another poet called Mortino Giron who wrote in Irish about most beautifully about the Aran Islands. And he lived up the road too.
That's amazing. So you've got poets wandering the streets.
You did have poets. Oh, no, I met it. I mean, Michael Hartnett, whose work I think informs Phil's more than anyone. I met him on my wedding day in my wedding dress outside the Shelburne Hotel on Stevens's Green. He thought I was Tom Kinsella's daughter, who's a poet. but it all felt very lucky to meet a poet on your wedding day.
But this is interesting, right? Because you know this poet for their work, for their lyricism, for this kind of big artistic self that they are, yet you see them down at the pub or maybe you can see them going down to buy milk or whatever.
The poets didn't drink as the way the prose writers were famous for doing.
Why not?
Well, I mean, the image of the drinking writer owes an awful lot to Tony Cronin's marvellous book, Dead as Doornails, where he traced, you know, Patrick Kavanagh, Brendan Behan, Flann O'Brien in the pubs of central Dublin. And that's become a kind of central tourist itinerary now. But there were plenty of writers who went home and worked or who took one look at it and said, that's not for me. It was quite a toxic space, you would call it now. They were very competitive. They were very sometimes degraded in their drinking. And women had a very poor time of it altogether. but I don't think Austin Clark drank. I don't think Mortimer Duran was, you know, impeccably respectable. I can't think of a drinking poet off the top of my head.
Wow. So I guess my point was...
Yes, I can, but I'm not going to name them here.
I guess my point was there's this separation, right, between the artistic self and this real person who goes about their life in Dublin. And I guess you could see that, right, because you could see them on the streets and then go home and read their work.
Well, yeah. Anytime I talk about Ireland, it just sounds like, really? We used to have a woman called Kitty used to come and do for my mother on a Friday, she wasn't very good at it. She did a lot of chatting and holding the tea towel. But I remember her imitating W.B. Yeats walking again along Stephen's Green with his hands behind his back and counting the meter with his hands. So he was writing a poem as he walked. And she walked up and down our hall, imitating what she had seen, which was Yeats walking through the streets. So that sense of proximity is very electrifying, really. You know, people are very interested in it. People would note when they saw writers. My mother saw Walter Machen at a daily mass, a writer who was censored by the church. There he was on his knees getting communion. Anyway, they were an object of gossip and interest, but also the prose books were so private and sometimes so transgressive by, you know, the manners of the time that it was like seeing somebody who was openly damaged or who was carrying the hurt, you know, in a kind of public way.
Yeah, it's like you'd read their diary and you could see them walking around.
Yeah, so it was a really surprising form of public intimacy, yeah.
Yeah. Have you dabbled in poetry over the years?
Dabbled. Well, you see, I wrote bad poetry when I was 16. But when I was writing Phil and I thought, what would happen if I wrote the poems? I realised I was writing fake poems and there's no such thing as a fake poem. A poem has to be real. So I sent it to a friend who is a very kind poet called Jane Clark. And I said, is this a poem? And I mean, the better question would have been, why not? I mean, the answer is, why isn't it a poem? It looks like a poem. It moves like a poem. It's broken up into lines. Some of it rhymes. It's a poem. Why wouldn't it be a poem? But I felt a poem was like something else that I wouldn't be able to do, that it was something semi-sacred, I suppose.
I read an article you wrote, an essay you wrote about COVID, where you said it was hard to write prose during COVID because prose, it was too social a medium, but it felt like a time of poetry. Can you explain that?
So the world had disappeared. I mean, the world had disappeared. The market, book, the readership, everything had disappeared. In those first few weeks of lockdown, March 2020 in Ireland, we were all confined to 2 kilometres from home and I walked up Killiney Hill in this a dry, beautiful, warm spring we had, the kind of generosity of the weather. And look down on Killiney Hill, you can look down over Dublin, and there were all these lives. And it just actually felt like being 16 again, where everything is hugely significant and quite lyrical. So I looked down at all these lives that had stopped for the whatever we didn't know. And meanwhile, the spring was happening all around me. The ferns were unfurling in the leaf mould and the branches were budding, and it was astonishing. So I went back down. I was writing Carmel, who's this tough-minded, get-on-with-it sort of character. But what I was reading, you couldn't read books that were just coming out, which is a lot of your job sort of in the marketplace, is to keep up with what's happening in the world of letters. That didn't matter anymore. So I went back to Tom Kinsella's translations from the Irish of a book spanning several centuries of poetry from the Irish. I went back to a language I don't really know very well. And I read two poems there about the deaths of little birds. One was a lament for a lady's pet blackbird, written, I think, in the 16th century. And the other was a famous Irish poem about a yellow bittern who dies from thirst because the lake is turned to ice and he can't drink. It's a drinker's poem. And these two tiny bodies of birds, the fact that they were mourned in verse that was still fresh on the page for me so many hundreds of years later. It was just a tiny piercing thing. It was sometime later I realised that I opened the gathering with the body of a dead bird weathering by the wall. It was just such a small mortality amid, you know, potentially huge deaths and losses. Anyway, so that's what I did, yeah.
Read poetry.
I read poetry. Once I realised that Phil was a poet, I knew he was going to leave. And once I knew that he was a poet, I thought, he took all the poetry with him. So Carmel is left in a life that has no poetry, as a lot of women are.
Yeah, so in The Wren, The Wren, we have Carmel. She is the daughter of Phil McDarrah, the poet. Growing up with a famous parent is something you wrote about in Actress, and you write about it again in this book. I guess it comes back to that divide we were talking about earlier between the public self, the lyrical poet, and then the real person who ups and leaves. That must be so confusing for a child to know both of those people at the same time, the public and the private.
So I think it happens to us all. I mean, can you remember one day you saw your mother walking in the street and you thought, oh, that coat. Oh, that's my mother. Oh, look at her now. Or one day I met my father in central Dublin to open a bank account when I was 18. And he said, there was a staircase in this bank. And I just said, he said, I thought you were my mother. Because we never met outside the house. We never went anywhere. it was very, very small domestic round when I was growing up. So that... Already that uncanny recognition, sense of recognition is already interesting. Before you add in the idea of the crowd or of the glamour, of the public glamour, there's a wonderful stage when you realise that your mother wears perfume, which is, you know, the scent of her leaving and what leaving involves. These are really intriguing infantile threshold moments that yield richly for story, I think. So add in a million people in Actress,
and or a million people who say, I love your mother or I love your father, and you say, no, I love them.
Yes, yeah, I suppose.
So, you know, there's this kind of global love compared to the very private love.
Yes, and it gives it kind of frisson or a tingle of self-consciousness. Which I also like.
Do you think about this for yourself? I mean, you are a Booker-winning writer. You are an important woman. For your own kids, do they see the divide between the public and the private?
They do and they don't. I mean, I remember the week I won the Booker and I was walking my son into school, and it was his first week at school. Actually, I was shortlisted, and he said, why are they gratulating you? It's my first week at school. quite right. So I felt, I think, for all of the years of their childhood and maybe into their teenage years, that they weren't bothered by... your children know you on some astonishing sort of texture. They know the texture or the timbre of your voice, or they know you in some way that isn't externalized. So I think that was something that I was happy was constant. Yeah. I mean, they're kind of a bit more interested in it now.
Yeah.
But I remember Bono saying, oh, my kids think I'm the most boring, you know, boring, stupid... You know, they're so uninterested in his fame on that level.
You started your book, The Wren with the character of Carmel. She's a single mother. She's Phil McDarrah's daughter. She doesn't suffer fools. Do you know where this character came from? Do you know where she began?
I don't know where she came from, but I know where she's going. She's quite a complex character, morally speaking. But people do recognise what I'm talking about, this get on with it sort of person who doesn't know. I mean, I had a hilarious time writing this conversation between herself and Nell, and Nell is talking about a friend of hers who suffers from anxiety, and she says, well, what does that mean? And she said, oh, you know, she's flying and the guy beside her on the plane doesn't switch off into airplane mode, and she thinks the plane is going to crash. And she said, well, the plane isn't going to crash. And Nell says, I know, I mean, we know that, but still she finds it very difficult. And Carmen says, oh, you mean she's stupid? So everyone has to do what I say because I'm stupid. Is that what anxiety is? But Nell says about her that she doesn't believe in allergies. That was very common when I was growing up, or intolerances. That if someone was, for example, groping for an EpiPen, she might allow them.
But I think she says
have an allergy. But the rest of it, she says, is all your imagination. So people who have problems deserve to have them because they imagined them. So it's all in your head. I mean, that was a phrase of my childhood for certain. It's all in your head. Or you've too much imagination. Carmel has no imagination. So people say to her, Carmel, you've no imagination. She's kind of glad about that, actually. Seems a bit of an encumbrance and an imposition on, you know, the idea of writing stuff and expecting people to read it. That doesn't make sense to Carmel. I mean, they have other things to be doing with their time. And why would you? You know?
I mean, there's a reason she's suspicious of imagination, right? Because
yeah.
of her dad.
Yeah.
So can you tell us what happened in the family? What happened when he left?
So there was this terrible rupture. I mean, her mother got seriously sick and her father couldn't handle it. And he, you know, he left. She thinks of it that he left on one day, but I mean, he might just have stomped off to the pub. I mean, it wasn't necessarily an organized or strategic move on his part. He was anguished and chaotic and loved his wife so much he couldn't bear to see her sick. So he's like, he is a perfect example of the artist or poet or human being that you know who thinks that their emotions about the situation are all that matters. You know, that's the reality. He can't see it from another point of view. So he leaves, and Carmel and her older sister are left looking after their mother. And she was already a fairly solid, grounded sort of individual, Carmel, but I think that moment of rupture is where her personal style really settled into, okay, his leaving robbed her of reverie. What would happen if she entered into the dreamscape or the imaginative space that is such a resource to people? She couldn't do that anymore. So, I mean, that is a terrific loss. Mm.
You made Carmel pregnant in the writing room. How did that happen?
Well, with sex. technically, you know, you have to organise it. But once I realised that she was going to have Nell, the whole book made sense to me, because there is a feeling that babies can bring of great return, that the things that you have lost have been returned to you, that loss is fixed. It feels like a wonderful restitution, as well as all kinds of other things. So when Nell arrives, she looks at her mother and her mother thinks this baby knows exactly how lonely she has been all her life. So she loves this child and idealizes this child. This child is everything to her. And once I knew that, I also knew that she was going to fuck it up.
Because why? Like, why did you know she was going
to? Because that was her tragedy. That's why she was a tragic figure. I mean, it's not enough to say that she's too sensible or that she's too pragmatic. These are not tragedies. I mean, they are on some level a self-limiting kind of thing going on there. But it has to matter to her for it to matter to us.
Mm. There's a beautiful line that I just wanted to shout out. Whenever Carmel sees Nell, the movie returns to Technicolor.
Yes.
It's like that thick, ecstatic light.
Well, Carmel is a distinctive kind of person and a different kind of person to Veronica. She thinks, I'm really interested now, and the book begins with Nell being interested in this, the idea that people's minds are really different. Like some people don't think visually, some people intuit things but don't name them. Some people have internal monologues going on all the time, other people don't. So Nell is talking about this and she says, you know, what do men think about? That is one of the great subjects of my work, what do men think about? And the answer is, in this case, the football. What are you thinking about? The football. So I did some deep research on this and asked my husband, what do you think about when you think about the football? Like, do you see the play and, you know, do you think about the strategy of the game, or do you see it in your mind? Do you hear anything? He said, no, I just think maybe it's time I should check the results. So, I mean, that's a way of talking as... I know that that's not what he's always thinking. Put it that way. It's what you say you're thinking, what you are thinking are can also be different things. But I just love the idea of people having different neurological styles, and Carmel's is very different. So the room coming into Technicolor is a return of all that kind of childhood possibility that left with her father.
Carmel's daughter Nell is a free spirit. She's a romantic. What's her relationship with her grandfather, Phil McDarrah's work?
When things get bad, she says, between herself and her mother, she curls up with a poetry book to sweeten the hurt. And so she reads her grandfather's poetry and wonders, how did her mother turn out to be so stupid and dull when clearly the grandfather was so interesting? And lovely. And the poetry is lyrical, and there is solace in lyricism, and she takes that, yeah.
What about the relationship between Nell and Carmel? You know, she says she's so stupid and dumb, but she also says, I'm never in doubt that I love this woman. Like, it's so complicated.
It is complicated. So, I mean, the tragedy of having children is that they're always leaving. They come back and they leave, and they come back and they leave, and they leave a little bit more each time, perhaps. So, yeah, herself and Nell, I can't remember what the line is, but during her teenage years, I think Nell describes it as a spiraling embrace of death or something, really kind of over the top, that they can't leave each other. And in a conversation around the middle of the book, Nell realizes that neither of them can rescue each other, even though they love each other completely. Now, the only thing to do with this love is to separate. The separation is the only thing that can happen. So that is kind of tragic as well, isn't it?
I think, you know, you do write so beautifully about families and how complex and flinty the love can be. There's a line in The Gathering where Veronica says, you know, she understood why her mother had all those holes in her head. She understood where she was coming from, but she could never forgive her for it. And I think there's something interesting in families that sometimes we can be compelled to be the cruelest version of ourselves in the family.
Well, yeah, I mean, it is context dependent. I mean, Veronica's mother is, and I didn't meet at least one woman who was like this, who had given birth to so many children and reared so many children, she didn't entirely know whether you were one of them or not. But yeah, the wrong colour hair. And Veronica's infantile rage at the absence of her mother really permeates the book. And the book was written in 2004, 2003 and became more successful than I had intended, I think. I always imagined a kind of small, select readership, which of course you are. But I went around then after the booker reading this first chapter of this book, and I thought, oh my God, it was very taboo breaking. I mean, her absolute anger at her mother. It really took on the kind of iconography of the Irish mother, really head on, you know, the much adored figure of the Irish mother. Veronica did not adore her mother for having so many children. She rather the opposite. Anyway, that was her. What was the question about Carmel?
Well, I guess the question about, you know, we're talking about anger, right? The anger we show towards each other. There's a scene in the book, which we're not going to spoil, in the Wren, but there's a moment where Carmel snaps. She loses it. And her fury with her daughter at that moment is so big.
Yeah.
Yet it so quickly shifts to shame or to regret. Like, what's going on for Carmel in that moment?
So people ask me about anger and rage, and there are many different styles. It's like, because the feelings of flooding are so absolute that it's only one thing. But if you look at male anger then as a template to say, okay, well, there's noble anger, there's grievance, there's tetchiness, there's passive aggression. You know, there are so many different categories and styles of showing anger. And physical violence is just one of a whole range of possibilities. So if you shift that into a female context, you're in the world of voodoo and taboo. I mean, this is really very under-discussed. And that's partly for social reasons. Society needs women to keep cleaning up and smiling. Okay, keep smiling, keep smiling. So never be angry. So when one critic described The Gathering as an angry book, as though that meant it was not a good book, I thought, well, there were reasons for that anger in that book. Why is an angry woman a wrong thing? Because women have more reasons to be angry than the other gender has. So why are we so abundantly supplied with cause and yet the effect is never to be shown or seen? So that's kind of interesting for a start. When Carmel has this kind of break, it's more a break than anything else. She realizes that her father is right there.
Yeah.
So the book is really interested in how violence particularly, rather than anger, violence is shown and translated in different terms in different generations.
Well, when Carmel's a young girl, in those years after her dad leaves, her sister Imelda just hits her. Seems like all the time, and Carmel just...
Oh, yeah.
Accepts it like, oh, this is what Imelda needs to do to get through the day.
So somebody was interviewing me and said, oh, I love the cleansing power of that.
Right.
And I thought, okay, I really haven't written that properly then. That's right. What Carmel thinks when Imelda is under a lot of pressure, slaps her all the time, and she thinks, well, it's good to have it in the room, like somebody has to do it. And she calls her little sister a pain. You're such a pain. So the pain is in the room. And Carmel is happy to have it called out. Well, that's an interesting, or it's one particular response. But going back to Phil has his own chapter in the book.
Mm-hmm.
And he mentions his mother. He grows up in a small cottage that would be recognisable on an Irish postcard and in the, you know, lyrical tradition of hedgerows and, you know, the countryside, and it's all supposed to be lovely. And we realise that there's five children and two adults sleeping in the same room now. It doesn't look as lovely as it was presented back in the day. So poets like Patrick Kavanagh had a way of taking poverty and making it feel noble, lyrical, and, you know, and empowering the poor, which is not a bad project, but perhaps false in some ways. Anyway, his mother, it's a half a line in that chapter. His mother gets a job as a substitute teacher, and she cycles off with her cheeks rosy and her arm grown lean in beating children that were not her own. And you realize that the domestics there are just constant. It's just like breathing. That it's their form of communication almost. And the violence in that chapter is a scene of terrible animal cruelty in that chapter, which is kind of sacramental. There's a badger baiting thing. So it's a collective violence, very male audience for it. And it's noble. So that's that generation. You realize then when Phil goes around giving his children a clatter upside the head, that violence is seen as somehow inevitable. It's like the weather. It's your fault if you don't get out of the way. It's very much the way Ireland was in the 60s and 70s, 50s, 60s and 70s, how children were regarded. Then when it is enacted in the present day, when it happens between Carmel and her daughter, it is terrible. It is just terrible. And that is what, you know, a lot of the patterns you recognise after the fact, but I was very pleased with how that thread had borne that result in the book. That made a lot of sense to me.
And then in the present day, we have Nell as a young woman who goes out with this guy, Willem. Yeah. She's obsessed with him. And from the get-go, you know, his party trick is he picks her up by the head. That's what he does.
I didn't do research on that. I don't know if it's actually physically, anatomically possible to pick someone up by the head. But anyway.
But it suggests, I mean, just the physical power he has over her.
Yeah, he's a big boy.
That he will exert over her through this relationship. And, you know, that the sex is rough. It's unpredictable. He's inattentive. Yet it seems like the worse he treats Nell, the more her obsession grows. Like, does she think this is romance? Like, what is she doing?
Ask her. I must ask her. She does realise, I suppose, by the end of the book, what she is doing. What does she think she's doing? She thinks she's waiting for him to call. That ancient occupation. She thinks she's in thrall. She thinks she's in a doomed relationship. She likes the wrongness of it. She's interested in the doominess of it. She's taken or addicted by the intermittence of the satisfactions. She finds the violence makes sense to her at least once until it doesn't sexually. So I was really interested in all that. I found it kind of gutting to write because I'm seeing more and more of it in young women's fiction. And I thought, oh God, I didn't know this is where we were going with our feminism. When my feminism came of age, we were, you know, in the 70s, the idea was we were all going to have a great time. Repression, the end of repression meant that people would engage as equals and have a really, really good time, even in bed. So the fact that women are increasingly writing about submission and masochism is a really intriguing addition to the conversation, I think. I just wanted to see what it was, to imagine it more fully, I think.
Mm. There's a letter in the book that Phil, the poet's second wife, writes to Nell when she's an adult. And in the letter, this woman says that women loved Phil not despite of, but because of his badness.
Yeah.
Which was a bit of an aha moment for me, like maybe it was talking about something with Nell and Phelim as well.
Yeah, I mean, we used to have a prime minister, a Taoiseach called Charlie Haughey, and people talked about the whiff of sulphur off him, that people liked the fact that they knew he was corrupt and had a mistress, and he enacted freedoms that they were not allowed themselves. So you look at autocrats and you look at figures who shall not be mentioned here, and you say, what do people see in that terrible man?
We like him in because of, not in despite of his badness.
Yes.
This is the book show coming to you from Adelaide Writers Week, where I am speaking to Anne Enright. And you do a wonderful job with Nell of capturing the voice of this young woman. And of course, social media is a big part of this as well. She kind of soothes herself by watching videos of kids getting cochlear implants, you know, switched on. Are you tapped into this world? Are you?
Well, the day is long, you know, you're typing away and the Wi-Fi is on. You might be doing research, find yourself looking at animal reunion videos, which feature strong, and that is research. Then I turn that into research. So Nell is very interested in, you know, the lionesses bounding up to the people who reared them as as cubs. And there's a particularly nice one with a girl and a donkey. Swans are good. Yeah, they make Nell cry.
Yeah, and crying is good. But how much do you think her being on this online world is adding to her own insecurities?
Well, there is a scene in the book where you realise that Phelim is right there. She sends him a picture and he goes ding back on the phone and you think, oh my God, I thought when I was writing it, he is right there. Mm. That the phone means that her life is incredibly porous to whatever is out there. It's in the room, it's right there. So I think that's quite frightening. It's technically problematic writing the internet. I mean, I remember students once saying, oh, I can't do emails in my book because Sally Rooney did that and so did Patricia Lockwood. And I thought, well, there's more than two people online, okay? It is so much a part of their world that to leave it out is to falsify their existence. So you don't know whether Nell is looking at a screen or looking at the world, and it's almost like she doesn't know it herself. There's no distance. There's no picking up of phones and typing in addresses or whatever. It just happens in a seamless kind of flow. That's where her consciousness is. It's between the world and the screen. I don't know how frightening that is. It is frightening to realise that, for example, her abusive boyfriend is right there. Mm. Also, she stalks his other woman, all kinds of chewy, good stuff, yeah.
I think the reason some people fear putting the internet into their books is just that that world is changing so fast. There's a danger that your book is dated before totally. It even goes to print. Like, does that worry you?
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, there's a clip of Phil that was taken in 1983 in a studio in America, and Carmel finds it online because she looks. She thinks to look up her father online. Nell just gets it on her phone and looks at this thing and says, what's that? Oh, God, it's my grandfather. Her phone is telling her where it is. And that's really uncanny to see this moving image of their kind of this figure in their lives, that he's alive in the online space. There's 26 views. And you kind of think, well, what'll our grandchildren see? What access will they have to our lives? It's just quite astonishing. There are three or four pictures of my grandmother, and each of them feels iconic, that you could look at it for a very long time and wonder about her personality and her life, and you could build her rooms around her by looking at this sepia-tinted photograph. So that's no longer the case. Our lives are so documented.
Yeah, people won't have the time to go through all the pictures we have. There's just too much there.
Yeah, well, may we live that long.
You were the Irish laureate, the first Irish laureate. What does that actually mean? What is that job?
Well, I kind of had to make it up as I went along because it was half an honour and half a job. So I had to write some essays and deliver some lectures. And do actually what a lot of Irish writers do anyway, which is encourage other Irish writers, new Irish writers, into the public square and interview them and whatever. But it's a very collegiate community in Ireland already. So I was just doing that for 3 years. And now I don't do any of it anymore. No, that's not true. But I took the distinction very, very seriously and decided to kind of out the unconscious, mostly unconscious bias that there was in the Irish reviewing space, to a really surprising amount. I mean, it was 2016 when I started, inspired by a group who called Waking the Feminists, who realised that the Abbey Theatre wasn't putting on any plays by women for their centenary celebrations. This is 1 out of 10. And my cry at the time is that there'd been so many bad plays at the Abbey, we needed more bad plays by women. So the fact that there wasn't any good was no excuse, because it was always bad plays by men that you saw. Anyway, But it was a really interesting twist of consciousness that happened right then, because it had happened elsewhere in the UK and the US and here perhaps. But Ireland was so busy being Irish, you know, and being melancholy and playful and lovely, that it didn't kind of think about gender in that way. So I started doing the count. So I opened the Irish Times one Saturday and looked at the reviews, and there were all reviews of books by men. I mean, 100%. It didn't say Men's Book Week. It didn't say we're doing a special about men this week that they used to do about women, you know, here's something special. Then the next week I picked it up. I said, oh, well, it was all male again. And then on the third week of January in maybe 2013, there was one review of a book by a woman out of 21. So I knew that, you know, the newspapers are in crisis, the staffing levels are problematic. It was probably just incompetence, and the incompetence defaulted nearly 100% male. So I thought it was time to really do it properly. And I did. I did quite a lot of work. I got a researcher, did a lot of statistics, and I published it outside of Ireland. Because the thing about women complaining is it's just women complaining. So there was no point in complaining, because that can't be heard. That's not the kind of discourse that can be acted on. That's just the weather. So I had to do it properly. I had to come out fully armed, get in and do it properly, which is what I did.
It does seem so much. Yes. It does seem like the tide has turned in that regard. You know, I was just scribbling down names just then, you know.
Sure.
Claire Keegan, Sally Rooney, yes. Louise Kennedy, all these incredible writers. What has changed? Has the appetite changed? Like, what's happening there for women writers in Ireland?
So I was only really surfing a wave that hadn't been noticed yet. I mean, it was 2 minutes later, it seemed everything had changed. And that is the nature of change, that it feels so wrong. Just at the moment as it's changing, you know, that people realise that the new is on its way. I don't know. I mean, the readership for both men and women writers has been mostly female. So I think the internet has made that more democratised, has democratised the critical space. People have opinions and they're not shy about airing them. Sometimes you wish they would be a little more shy. In some areas, but I think in the realm of books, it has been a really organically time of growth for the readership.
And you're sitting there having blazed that trail, you know, all that time ago. Is that a thrill to see this new crop of writers coming through?
Yeah, I suppose. It's complex. It is. I love their confidence. I love the fact that things can be said now that couldn't be said. I mean, it's really what I've spent my life working towards, an atmosphere in which that could happen. I am, in one sense, delighted. In another sense, I'm always thinking, what am I going to write now?
Well, I can't wait to see whatever it is. Please thank the brilliant Anne Enright.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Claire. Thank you. Thank you.
That was Anne Enright with me at Adelaide Writers' Week. Anne's latest novel is The Wren, The Wren. I love this book, but do check out Anne's other work too. She's written 8 novels, including her non-fiction book, Making Babies. I'm Claire Nichols, and thank you as always to Sarah Lestrange, who's been hanging out with me here at Adelaide Writers' Week. Together, we've collected a bunch of interviews with interesting people. We're going to bring you those over the coming weeks. So stay tuned. Make sure you're following The Book Show on the ABC Listen app or on your podcast app of choice. Bye.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.